Hey, what's good, everybody? This is Bo Brown, and I am back with episode 3 of Lukewarm Takes. Okay, so let's get right into it today. The first thing I want to talk about is a hip-hop artist, sort of an up-and-coming guy named Marlon Craft. First heard of him when I was listening to an Apple Music. You know how you can create a radio station based on one artist, and then it will play automatically songs based on similar artists. And so I think I had created a station based on Sean Price, the late great Sean Price, rest in peace. And so they were playing a lot of stuff that was somehow related to Sean Price, at least sonically. And so a lot of boom bappy stuff from Duck Down Records, Sky Zoo, a lot of East Coast stuff. But then I started hearing this song that I had never heard before. And most of the songs that play on this particular radio station, I've heard many times, but this one was new, and every once in a while you get a new song, and sometimes it's not so great, but sometimes it's really good. And this particular song was by an artist named Marlon Craft, and really liked what I heard, so I thought I'd check it out. I think I was cleaning or something while I was listening, so I ran over there, put it on pause, looked at the song title. It was a song called Brainiacs, Brainiac plural, and just loved it. It had like a real boom bap feel. Marlon Craft was rhyming really nicely. He really had that East Coast sort of flow, really in the pocket, like a Sky Zoo or a Joey Badass or Kool G Rap type thing. You could just tell a New York rapper when you hear a New York rapper. So lo and behold, went and did some research on where this particular song came from and where this artist came from, and discovered that he indeed is from New York, New York City, an area called Hell's Kitchen, which as I understand it is a pretty ethnically diverse neighborhood, it seems like it's also lower on the socioeconomic scale, but that's neither here nor there. It's just where he's from. And so I started learning a little bit more about this guy. He sounds much older than he actually is. I think he's in his 20s. I found out that he's been on one of the either Sway in the Morning or the Breakfast Club. Maybe both. He could have made the rounds. I think those are both. Well, I know Breakfast Club is based in New York, so maybe that one is the more likely one with Charlamagne. But anyway, on record, he sounds great. In the studio, he sounds great, like on Breakfast Club. And I was just like, wow, this is a great new artist. Like I said, he's a young guy. Went and found out that he's got this album called Tunnels End, which, come to find out through Twitter, he actually doesn't consider that one an album. It's more of a mixtape, although I believe all the beats are original. It's not like the radio mixtapes used to hear where people would just rhyme over other popular beats at the time. So it sounds more like an album to me, but maybe as an artist he doesn't feel like it's a super cohesive work. It's not, maybe he just feels like it's a bunch of songs thrown onto one project. But he said that he doesn't consider that his debut album. He really considers whatever is coming next, which I believe it will be this year, to be his true album. Now, he does have another EP out. I forgot the name of it. It's something to do with love, maybe. But I really, one of the things I like about him, other than his obvious skill as an MC and his beat selection, is the fact that he just talks about real, authentic, kind of normal stuff. He talks about being broke, which a lot of us can relate to. He talks about riding the subway in New York, talks about having bad days, talks about his love for music, and just normal everyday things that probably anybody could relate to, no matter the color of your skin, where you came from. Just he's real relatable in his content. So I really like Marlon Craft. I think everybody should check him out. So if you're interested, I would just have two recommendations. The first is to go listen to his project, The Tunnel's End, which I believe is available probably any streaming service. Apple Music is what I use, but Spotify or any of the others, probably can find it on YouTube as well. And then the second thing I would recommend, if you're interested in Marlon Craft, would be to go to his Instagram page, which I believe it's just Marlon Craft, like not like Kraft mac and cheese, but craft like you have a particular craft, like woodworking or something like that. Craft. I guess I could have just spelled it. Go check out his Instagram, and he's doing this series of short videos, very simple videos where he rhymes what seems to be one, maybe 16 bars, maybe 32, somewhere around there. Real simple. It's just him looking into the camera with some sort of colored background, and things are happening around him having to do with the lyrics that he's rhyming at that time. So it's real cool. It's a real creative idea. They're called episodes, and he hashtags episodes. I think he's done like four at this point. But he is just a creative, skillful person, and I look to see him really making a name for himself in the coming years. He really brings back a sort of early 90s, mid 90s appeal. But he doesn't sound dated, I guess I should say. It still sounds fresh. It still sounds like it doesn't sound like he's trying to imitate artists that have that more 90s New York boom bap style. It just seems like that's what tends to come authentically for him. Probably part of that is just growing up in Hell's Kitchen in New York City, having those influences growing up. So check out Marlon Craft on his Instagram, his Twitter. The dude actually will respond if you have questions. That's another thing I've really appreciated about him. He'll like your comments. He's real interactive with his fans, and I hope he doesn't lose that either as he inevitably gets bigger and bigger. So, like I said, check out Marlon Craft. I think you will not be disappointed. All right, let's move on. For the theology segment today, I want to talk a little bit about Calvinism, which is one of the more popular movements throughout the past 500 years in European Christianity. Is this stream of theology and ecclesiology and all the rest called Calvinism. And full disclosure, I'm a Presbyterian minister, and the Presbyterian / Reformed tradition basically comes out of Calvin and some other church leaders that were active in and around France and Switzerland in the 16th century, the 1500s. And so there's a lot of influence of Calvin, at least historically, within the Presbyterian church. Today, I think there's been some distancing from Calvin, especially the past probably 20 years or so. where more conservative evangelicals have taken on the mantle of Reformed theology, and a very truncated, smaller, I think, version of Calvinist theology, which is often called five-point Calvinism, known by the acronym TULIP. And if I try to name what all those letters from the acronym are right now, I'd probably get them wrong. So I'll let you look that up. Calvinism, TULIP, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, P is perseverance of the saints. So I guess I know 4/5, 80% of it. But anyway, what do I think about Calvin? I guess some background information would be important first. Calvin arose in, was born and grew up in France, in an area that was obviously heavily influenced by the Roman Catholic Church. After all, that's really all there was up until the 1500s, other than the Orthodox Church, which had split in the early part of the second millennium after Jesus was born, often called the Common Era. Calvin grew up in France and was a Catholic, got interested in law, went to law school, then got interested in theology, and somehow, some way, came under the influence of these theologians, church leaders, who were calling themselves, or maybe we've called them posthumously, Reformed church leaders, or part of the Reform movement, which is similar to the Lutheran movement, but different in some ways. The legend goes, or maybe it's actually been verified, that the Lutherans, or the people who followed Luther in his exodus, or his excommunication from the Roman Catholic Church, were Reformed, but that because of the Protestant Reformation, but that the quote unquote Reformed Christians were more Reformed. So the idea here is that Luther and his people that adhered to his theology really did the theological work of reforming doctrine, particularly around how are you saved, how are you justified, how are you made righteous. Luther said, by grace through faith. So that was the theological side. But then the so-called Reformed Christians, who John Calvin was very influenced by and became one of the greatest leaders, most active leaders in the Reform movement, they actually put the theological work into practice in the church. So the idea is that they turned ecclesiology turned theology, the study of God, into ecclesiology, the practice of how we are church, how we organize as a community. So anyway, I knew nothing about Calvin until probably I was about 19, 20 years old. I had heard about him mainly in the context of this old debate between so-called Calvinists and so-called Arminians. This was a debate that arose out of the Dutch Reformed, the Dutch Calvinist context. I should probably say that Calvin eventually had to leave France because of his sympathies with the Reform movement, and ended up in Geneva, Switzerland, eventually, where he helped organize, helped pastor, helped. I don't know if he thought of it, but he definitely helped form this type of church government that was ruled by elders. He believed in the priesthood of all believers. So you had elders making decisions for the church, not just a priest, not just a pontiff, a bishop, something like that. There was no pope, obviously. They were very reactionary against the popes. But he really did do a lot of work, not all completely admirable work, but a lot of it was in creating the foundations for American government in some ways, and democratic government. There was a representative democracy, essentially. Sorry, I got interrupted by a phone call. There was a representative democracy within Reformed Presbyterian churches that exists to this day in both political and ecclesiological situations. Ecclesia is the root word, Greek for church, or literally the called out ones. All that to say is often when you hear people talk about their Calvinists, I think there is a distinction to be made between Calvinism and the theology and the thought of Calvin himself. Too often, I think when we hear Calvinism, we automatically think of this doctrine of predestination, particularly what's called double predestination, where some people are born and they are destined to go to heaven no matter, you know, what they do, they're chosen. And then other people are born and they are destined to go to hell, which is a pretty disturbing teaching, and one that I don't subscribe to. It is one that Calvin did subscribe to. And I think some of the reasoning behind that is that he was an oppressed person in some ways. Even though he was a somewhat wealthy Frenchman, he was oppressed because of his theological commitments and sympathies. He was basically exiled from France, from his home. And so when he started writing theology, he was writing from the context of an outsider, someone that the Roman Catholic Church had deemed outside the true church, and so therefore doomed to go to hell, essentially. If you're outside the true church, you're SOL, basically. So Calvin, in writing about double predestination, that some people are destined for heaven and certain people are destined for hell, is basically putting that in the face of the Roman Catholic Church, saying God chooses who's saved. You don't. The church hierarchy, the church authorities don't get to say who's saved and who's not. They don't get to say who the true church is. That's up to God. And so I think that helps me a little bit understand why Calvin was did subscribe to this thought of double predestination. But even so, it's still only a very small part of his theology, this teaching about some people going to hell, some people going to heaven, and nothing they can do to change that. It's only a very small part, although it is there. I think the reason why I still have respect for Calvin, even though I would never call myself a Calvinist, is that his idea, I think the driving force of his thought and his theology, was that God is on your side. So he was writing to these people back in France who were still being oppressed, who for their beliefs. And he was reminding them, I think, in many ways, that even though you're being rejected here on earth, even though you are not considered to be saved here on earth, God is on your side. And God is particularly close to the brokenhearted. And that's something that's carried through for me, to understand that Personally, when I'm feeling not oppressed, because I don't think I've ever been oppressed, but when I'm feeling particularly down or rejected, God is still on my side. And God is not only on my side, God is on the side of everyone, on the side of humanity, I should say. God has our best interests at heart and is pushing us to be the best that we can be. God doesn't make decisions beforehand, certainly, about our final destination, whatever that may be. But God is for us as humanity. God wants us to thrive and succeed. And then particularly taking a special look at those who are victims, who are extremely poor through no fault of their own, who hunger, who have mental illness, people who live in places where there are no opportunities to thrive and succeed. God is on the side. And so therefore, if we are followers of God, we also ought to be on the side of the victims and the oppressed and be working, trying to work with them to restore their dignity in some way, shape, or form, whatever that looks like for them. So I don't love Calvin, but I have some respect for his thoughts. I have some respect for the way he characterized God. And I don't think his God was a complete tyrant. I think his God was still very much on the side, particularly of people who need it the most. And that's all I got to say about Calvin today. I hope you don't dig into the Institutes because, oh my gosh, maybe you want to. But a book I would recommend if you're interested more in Calvin is a book, I think it's just called John Calvin, by an author and professor named William Stacy Johnson. John Calvin, I think the subtitle is A Reformer for the 21st Century. William Stacy Johnson. So check that out, and I'll be back in a few seconds. Hey, I'm back. So I said a couple weeks ago that I might be getting into talking a little about politics, even though that can be a somewhat inflammatory subject and people can, you know, go get their pitchforks and ready to attack. I don't think it has to be like that. And unfortunately, it often looks that way when you watch cable news or you hear stories about the way that things happen, particularly in Washington, D.C. At the local level, sometimes it's a lot better. But I don't think discussion of politics needs to be needs to cause such anxiety and such feelings of animosity. I think it can be a lot more productive than that. So the question that I want to talk a little bit about today for the next 5 to 7 minutes or so, because I got to go here, is did Trump lie about the wall? Did President Trump lie about the wall? Because, see, on the campaign trail, he said, you know, what are we going to do? And people would say, build a wall. And then he would say, who's going to pay for it? And people would say, Mexico. So there was this call and response thing. People were getting hyped up. And there was a lot of momentum around this idea of Mexico paying for the wall. So fast forward to where we are today. A national emergency has been called, and essentially the taxpayer is going to pay for this wall, which I think we knew all along. I would assume that most people knew all along that if there would be a wall, Americans would be the ones, you know, bankrolling the wall. Now, there is this thought that a reversing of the trade deficit with Mexico because of the new NAFTA program is supposed to, not NAFTA, the trade program that we have in North America. Yeah, it is NAFTA. The new NAFTA is supposed to decrease our trade deficit with Mexico and essentially pay for the wall, pay being used in very loose terms. So that's what it looks like is going to happen. There's going to be $2 billion for some fencing or some sort of barrier. It's not going to be a concrete wall. I don't think so. So the question comes up, did Trump lie? And I think, I don't know if that's the most productive question. Did President Trump lie? Because I think that question is meant to give me or anyone else some ammunition to go after the supporters of President Trump and say, well, he lied. He lied. How are you going to believe a liar? Don't you even care about the truth? And that seems to be a very unproductive way of addressing the issue of disagreement with building a wall or disagreement with a particular politician's policies or actions. Because what happens there is, I think, if somebody is doing something that we agree with, if one of our leaders is setting forth on a path that we also want to go down, then it doesn't matter if they've lied to get there. It's human nature to say, hey, they're on my side. And if they've got to bend the rules a little bit, if they've got to be a little, if they got to play the political games, then that's fine. Because in the end, the means will be justified because it will be a good end. And so if we were to come at somebody and say, hey, you're following a liar, they would say either no, he's not, and they would get on the defensive, or they would say, yeah, so he's my guy. And I don't think that's just a conservative thing to do or a liberal thing to do. I think it's a human thing to do. People we like, people that have been in our lives, have been positive influences in our lives in whatever way, shape, or form, we tend to justify and to excuse some of their actions that if another person that we didn't agree with in general were to do those same actions, we would be very upset and sort of inflamed with that sort of behavior. So I think there's probably another way to address disagreements. And I think outrage is not that way. For me, if I'm going to address disagreements, it seems like the best thing to do is to seek to understand. Now, I want to give a caveat to that. If a person is attacking your personhood, or they're being aggressive, and they are making you feel less than dignified and like less than a person, then you can walk away, because I don't think it's worth engaging in conversation with somebody who has already insulted your intelligence, has already made you feel like you are less than. Less than a human being. And so walk away from those conversations. But if you want to stay in relationship with a person and you don't feel like they're being actively antagonizing to you, seems like the best way to approach that is with a question. A question is a lot harder to balk against than a statement, especially a statement that comes across feeling condemnatory, that comes across as overly argumentative. So a question, if somebody states, I'll just throw out an example that we need to have a wall all across the southern border. Rather than saying you're an idiot or yes, you're absolutely right, we do, and just agreeing with what everybody says, I think a good tactic is just to say, well, I'm interested how you arrived at that conclusion, or what sort of experiences in your life have led you to feel like this is the best policy, this is the best way forward. To have a sort of questioning posture, not an aggressive questioning, because God knows a question can be used as a snare, and we're not trying to get somebody to walk into our trap so we can come out the victor in an argument, even though that too is human nature to want to win a discussion. But a discussion, I think the end goal of a discussion should be for the people involved in the discussion to walk away with more understanding of the other's position. That doesn't mean there's going to be an agreement. In fact, I think probably about 9 out of 10 political discussions end up with everybody still feeling the same way they felt when they entered the conversation. It's probably more than 9 out of 10. So if the chances are, if the odds are that this person is not going to change their minds, then maybe we can seek to understand their positions. And I've noticed in my case, when somebody questions something that I say, a statement that I make with maybe too much conviction, and they ask genuine questions, well, tell me how you got there. Walk me through the steps that helped you arrive at that idea, because I really want to understand. Sometimes I realize that I don't really know, or I thought I had really strong case for the position I was taking, but turns out there were some holes in the logic. And it's not them pointing out the holes, it's me trying to explain and then realizing, oh, I haven't thought about that aspect of it. So I think that type of conversation is really productive. Again, if it's not an abusive situation, if it's not an aggressive, no holds barred sort of argument, go in, seek to understand, and maybe walk away with some food for thought. You may not change your mind, or you may. You may slightly adjust your position, or you may even develop a stronger case for communicating your position in the future. I think that's what we need in our politics. And I understand you have to get to the practical aspects. At the end of the day, you got to have a vote, and the vote has to be pretty simple, yes or no. There's not a lot of room for nuance. But in conversation, there is. And maybe we need to see a little bit more of that in our families and our churches, and maybe even on cable news. So seek first to understand if you can. I think it's the best way to go. That's it for me today. I really hope you enjoyed the podcast. Rate me on Stitcher and Overcast and Spotify and Apple Music or Apple Podcasts, whatever platform you use. Drop me a rating. It's like people say when they do work for you, the 5 stars is always approved, or 4 stars if that's the most is always appreciated. So I'll see you next week. And I really hope you are blessed and you get to experience grace and peace in your life. So talk to you later. Bye.